I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here sober. It's nice to have that choice. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that choice. My home group is the Mid-Valley Group in Surrey, British Columbia, a suburb of Vancouver, and my sobriety date is September 30th of 99. I thought the topic was building a character. And I've got family here, I've got friends here, and I've got some hecklers here. So if you hear some heckling, those are just my good friends. So the ones that know me the best. I've led a very, very charmed life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way I look at building character is it's smashing my ego and gaining a little humility. And as my hecklers will point out, I still have an ego and I haven't got a lot of humility some days, but I'm working on it. And, that ego got smashed up the very first time I set foot in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, my sobriety date's in 99. The first meeting I went to was in 1989. I got news for you. If you don't want to quit drinking, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work very well. it's just saying. Okay. It's funny. Through the mid-90s, I couldn't tell you where I lived or what I was doing for money. But 1989, I remember that meeting. It was the old Vancouver Recovery Club. It was like walking into a dungeon. The stairwell was not wide enough for two of me now, okay, to get through at the same time. We could smoke in meetings then. There was guys bumming smokes, and there was a guy drunk. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, my head told me it wasn't where I belonged. Okay? But why did I keep going back? The message got through. And, I had nearly hit my bottom, not even close. I was still wearing a suit to work and telling people what to do. When I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous in 99, okay, there were no suits. I was driving what I called the Surrey Cadillac, which was a Cutlass Sierra that had a broken head gasket, and I couldn't drive it more than 5 miles without it overheating. My then one-year-old son was sleeping in a crib, and I slept in a cot beside his bed. Now, you guys get how that happens, okay? The people that I worked with, they couldn't ever understand that, So that very first day, my ego got smashed up knowing that Alcoholics Anonymous had the answer for me, okay? Skid Row A, meaning people drunk, and, in my head, my life was better drunk than theirs was sober. Of course, that's not true, and I know that today, but at the time, my head was ruling my heart. For the next 8 years, I bounced in and out of these rooms, 3 months, 9 months. And like I said, I couldn't tell you where I was living, who I was with, what I was doing for money. What I was doing for money for sure was after 93 was probably not legal or it was immoral. That's just the way it happened. I was in the casino industry when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous. In 93, I became unemployable in that industry. I'm not going to do my fifth step up here, but hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash that nobody knew how much it really was. It just happened to get into my hands somehow, and I never got caught, okay? It's funny. I got caught for bouncing checks through the company account and, through the company deposit, and I lost that job, and I was unemployable in that industry. And from 93 to 97, I have no clue. I hustled poker a bit. I basically lived by my wits and When I lost that job in 93, it was almost a relief. There was no more keeping it together now, okay? And, you know, I know people in this room understand, if you have a job where you're supposed to be doing something and telling other people what to do, it is very difficult to keep it together, okay? And it is very difficult to drink every day. And, you know, and this job, you know, in the casino business, I work from 8 till 4 in the morning, and, you know, I managed to not drink, you know, 4 days a week, okay? When I lost that job, I could do exactly what I wanted to do, and that was drink. And in 97, it got bad enough that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a little bit different attitude. And again, okay, you know, crawling back into these rooms with, you know, nothing, you know, that's a little humbling. And there's an old guy that lives in a town called White Rock, close to where I live, and you know, he says, if you don't find humility in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay, humility will find you. And humility found me, okay? Not then, but it found me in 1999. I managed to stay sober 27 months and 13 days. And my son had just turned one. And I picked up a drink, and I knew he wasn't going to have a father. Not a part-time father, not, you know, see you once in a while. I knew he wasn't going to have any kind of father. And I only drank 4 months. I grew up without a father because of this disease. And, you know, you would think, and I hear it in the room sometimes, you know, that, oh, if he loved his kids or if she loved her kids and stuff. I said, what big book did you read? Okay. You know, no human power. Okay, and that includes your kids. Okay, you know, my kid is 17 now. He's never seen me pick up a drink. Okay, I've been sober all but 4 months. Yeah, he's 17 and he's driving me crazy. Okay. So, you know, the funny thing is, and you know, I'll be all over the place here. I don't do this. Okay. I'm comfortable speaking at groups of that I go to a lot, and you know, when I do that, but here I'm not comfortable. But you know, if you think your kids aren't listening, okay, to AA stuff, okay, you know, I found out about 6 months ago my son's drinking and smoking pot, okay, and you know, I was shocked. Okay, what kind of idiot am I? Okay. But, you know, he said something to me. You know, we talked about it at length, and he said, Dad, I don't think I'm like you, okay? I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, when I have two drinks, I don't want anymore. So he already knows about the allergy, and, you know, it took me till I was 39 years old to understand that. And, you know, I'd been in AA, and you guys talked about it. I just had very selective hearing. But when I went out drinking in 99 after being sober a couple years, like I said, I only drank 4 months. I only saw my son a couple times during that time. But, you know, you stand at podiums or around a table and, you know, you're talking to the newcomer about how to stay sober, and I was completely full of shit, okay? Completely, okay? I had white knuckle meeting sobriety, okay? I was really happy that the steps were written because I could see that you guys really needed them. Okay. You know, me, on the other hand, I just needed to quit drinking. Okay, I didn't need to change anything. And, you know, when I came back to AA in 99, hopefully to stay, I came back with a little bit different attitude. I knew I needed to change some things. The first thing I needed to do was never set foot in my home group again. Okay, I'm back at that home group now, but I joined another group on Monday nights just so I wouldn't go there. I was going to put the same effort into Alcoholics Anonymous as I did into drinking, and, like, that's impossible. I don't know about any of you. At the end of my drinking was all I did, okay? If I wasn't hustling the money to drink, I was drinking, okay? I don't know. I guess maybe you could go to a meeting. If you lived in a big city, you could go to, you know, 5-6 meetings a day, and you can in Vancouver, but what are you going to do with the other time? Okay, drinking was busy for me, And I was going to fire my sponsor, okay, because he was obviously a big part of the problem. But I was Vancouver surrounded by water, so I had to wait to make sure that my car would make it across the bridge because it would be embarrassing. Okay, I waited a couple weeks, and I called him up and I announced to him that I was back in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, and he said, "So what?" You know, like I thought I'd phone in New York or something. I didn't know anything about AA really. I was phoning New York, see if I could get kicked out of AA for being mean or something. But, he really was not interested in any of my BS anymore. He really wasn't. And I was crazy. So I waited until my car would get across the bridge, which was about 3 weeks. And I sat across from a coffee shop from him. And, I told him exactly what I thought of him. I told him he was a terrible sponsor, a terrible friend, I was really not nice to him. Okay? And my sponsor's, he's 47 years sober now, so I guess he was 32 then. He's not a very big guy, okay? But he'd always talked about all these assault charges he got in early sobriety I actually thought he was embellishing, and, I tell you what, okay, at 32 years sober, he came completely unglued, okay? And I knew if I said one more stupid thing, I was going to the hospital, okay? You know? I could see it in his eyes, that, like, I've seen scary guys, and it was not pleasant. And, I didn't talk to him very much for that first year, and I asked someone else to give me my cake, actually, and, and the guy that was going to do it couldn't. He went back east for a while. And my sponsor and I got close. And admitting that you know nothing about AA after you've been hanging around for 8-10 years is humbling. Okay? And asking for help is humbling. I could never get through this story. Okay. I was 2 years sober, okay, and I called up my sponsor with one of my many broken shoelace problems, okay. It was such a big problem, I can't remember what it was, okay. But I said, "Are you busy today? I'd like to grab a coffee." I said, "How's your day?" And he said, "Not a great day, Joe. Dad died this morning. But if you need to talk, we can go for coffee." Now, if you're new, not everyone in AA is like that, okay? Okay? This is a great guy, He knew, and his dad wasn't just his dad. His dad was his sponsor and his best friend. That's the kind of help I've had. It's funny, I just said, "No, it's good, Bill. I don't need to go for coffee." But I never forgot that, okay? And I haven't called him once since then with a broken shoelace problem, with, a petty resentment and, petty BS stuff that, it just doesn't matter in the big scheme of things. And I felt so bad about myself that day that I was calling him, okay? And he's busy. He sponsors lots of guys, and he's a business guy. I felt so bad about myself that day, and that was humbling. I don't know if I have any character now, but I know that I think about things differently, okay? And that's because of you guys, and the program of recovery and the big book. What else, okay, made me a little humble? Okay? And the hecklers have been quite quiet, so I better I better be pretty nice, but... oh, good, I only got 5 minutes, okay? When I was about 10 and a half years sober, I ended a relationship with somebody I'd been with for about 6 years. I tried to end it like 5 times. Okay? And I just, it doesn't matter why. Okay. It didn't take. But when I ended it, she got drunk. Okay. And she was 14 years sober. And I took that on like it was my fault, okay? Like being that martyr, that sick crap that we do, or at least I do. And, I was going to leave my home group because then she could get sober. And thank God for good sponsorship, you know. He says, who the hell do you think you are? Okay? You know, like you leaving your home group's going to get somebody sober. Okay? Okay? Like anything you do is going to get somebody else sober. Okay? You know? Okay? And like, I really believe that, you know, and, you know, my sponsor's full of one-liners. We're talking about a guy who went out drinking, and we hadn't talked about him much for, you know, 6 months. And I said, geez, you know, if I went out drinking, you know, they quit talking about me in 6 months. And he said, don't flatter yourself. It'll be 3 months. Okay. But after this happened, I took on a lot of that, it was a really sick relationship. I was very controlling and made her not responsible for anything. Okay. And that was because of my insecurity. If I paid for everything and then she'd do what I told her or something. I don't know. Okay. Trust me, the woman I'm married to today, that would never fly. Okay. She's sitting right there, and you know, okay. I would never have married her if it was like that anyway. But just after my 11-year cake, I was in a real bad spot, and I was at a stop sign in my hometown, and the bar was straight, and turning right was going home. It was Halloween night 4.5 years ago, and four years and 8 months ago, and I could not think of one reason not to drink at 11 years sober. And people talk about, if you're thinking of drinking, go to a meeting or talk to your sponsor, and I did both those things that day. And it was right there. Yeah. A little humble, yeah. Okay. You know, and I share that at podiums because I want to be reminded, okay, that I'm one resentment, okay, one little thing away from a drink. And I don't know about you, when I came back after being sober a couple of years, it was the most humbling thing I've ever done in my life. And to come back after 11 years sober, I don't think so. I think it's a death sentence for me. Okay? My crazy alcoholic head would never allow me to walk through these doors again. And thank God, you know, that was Halloween night 4 years and 8 months ago. And I turned right and I went home and I got in bed at 6 o'clock at night on Halloween. And I woke up 3 or 4 hours later and I was okay. Okay, I wasn't okay. I knew I was in serious, serious trouble, but I knew I wasn't going to drink that day. And you know, there's been so many things in my life, you know. That incident, it's funny, I met my wife because of that 11-year thing. They announced her 11-year cake at a meeting, and I struck up a conversation with her, and she was trying to pillow talk me and told me in her early sobriety she punched a guy so hard she broke his jaw. So I'm driving home that night, and I live like 3 blocks from the meeting. I said, yeah, that's the girl for me. But anyway, she got even anyway. Our desks are about 20 feet apart at home, and she'd told me about doing some volunteer work at the convention, and then she said something about putting my name in to speak. And she did mention that she puts in lots of names, and my chances are, you know, not good at getting picked. I heard there's no chance of getting picked, okay? And, one of my hecklers was one of the guys that I was hoping that would get asked to share here. He's a gifted speaker and a good guy, except that he heckles me. I'm truly blessed to be here. And thanks for putting up with my tears. I knew I couldn't keep it together in front of you. You know, you guys are everything to me. That's a first. One of the hecklers gave me a standing ovation. But I love you guys, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and please, please come to Vancouver in 10 years. My wife and I will give you a guided tour. Okay, so, okay, thank you. Okay.
sharing section. Next, I would like to introduce Sunny O from New Jersey.
Hi, everybody. How's the volume? Can you hear me okay? Hi, everybody. My name is Sunny, and I'm an alcoholic. My husband just sent me a text. I love you. Be yourself. I'm pretty nervous. Well, at all, thank you. Okay, I'm going to start like this. I don't have a lot of time. And the temptation to be a character instead of showing my character is so tempting. The thought of, for the first time in my life, speaking in a microphone to such a big crowd is such a tempting opportunity for me to unleash my inner stand-up. And I can tell that you ought to be such a wonderful, gracious audience. But instead, the true message that I have today is kind of a nervous, shaky desire to tell you sincerely a little more about myself and the life that I've lived and some of the choices that I've made and what happened, and what things are like now. And somehow, in a roundabout, manipulative way, I'm going to try to fit step 6 and 7 in. So in the beginning, I go to rehab. Voluntarily, willingly, completely in the dark about my alcoholism. Usually, I don't have the humility to start with this part of the story, but today, in the audience, the head of the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper employee assistance program from 29 years ago when I got sober happens to be here today in the audience, the man who saved my life, Joe C. And I was at the shop steward training program. He's talking about workplace behaviors that may have something to do with substance abuse. I'm working in a newspaper, folks, and he's talking about drinking, drug use, pot smoking. He mentions pot smoking quite a bit. He talks about it as a gateway drug, a seemingly harmless drug, and he talks about, you know, productivity. Keeping in mind, it's a job. Okay, the next day and all that night, all I'm thinking about is this guy and his spiel. And I'm not thinking about the other people in my department at the newspaper. I'm thinking about myself. And the next day at 8 a.m., I'm in his office. And I'm telling him, and I'm just going to say this in passing, get it out of the way. I'm not telling him about my drinking. I'm telling him the truth about my 13-year, every day of my life, love affair with smoking pot. Up in the morning at 7, smoking pot to enhance my shower. Stopping on a Monday, starting again on Monday 5 minutes later. My drug dealer, my pot connection, was the teller at our local bank. I'd stop at the drive-in window. Yes, back in the day of the pneumatic tube. I think that you all get the idea. And based solely upon this conversation, I end up in a beautiful rehab. I'm there. It's the first day. Everyone's really nice. I'm really nice. The second day, I'm brought before the treatment team. Everybody's not so nice. They start asking questions. Not about my pot smoking. I was pretty honest and sincere. I came in voluntarily. I had made up my mind to change, to stop, and to put this all behind me. So no one gave me a hard time about that. But you know what they asked me about. They asked me about drinking. And I wanted to get all the answers right, and I told them that whenever I had more than 10 drinks, I had a really hard time remembering who I am, who you are, where I am, and how long I've been there. And I then would follow up by calling the people I thought I had been with to ask them if they could answer those questions. And they told me that that was called a blackout and that I was an alcoholic. This is when I immediately start crying in the most embarrassed and anguished way, and I say to them, I can't be an alcoholic. I'm Jewish. And, you know, I didn't leave the rehab the next day. I was there for 35 days, and I must have heard that story about 5 million times while I was there. And it haunted me, you know, for years and years and years. Now, the third day I was in rehab, I'm struggling with this new information. And I get a phone call from my mother. As a special courtesy, the treatment team allowed me to receive one phone call. And my mother told me that my father had had a really bad heart attack. Now, what I forgot to tell you was the night before I went into the rehab, my father called me on the phone, and he said, I love you. You're my baby girl. I don't know what your problem is, but you go get it fixed. And when you come out, I'm going to be so proud of you. And I'll be waiting. So my mother's telling me about Dad's heart attack. And she said, if he dies, you killed him. And she meant it, and I knew it. I got off the phone, and in the most polite, persuasive way possible, in my ladylike, manipulative little way, I did everything I could to get the treatment facility to allow me to go immediately to the intensive care unit. And they told me a simple hard truth, that there were only one set of rules, and if I left, I couldn't come back, and that my father would live or he would die. But this was my chance, and I better take it. So my first big opportunity to decide which road I would take in the terms of character and development was I decided that I would get sober and stay in the rehab. If I talk this slow, I'm not going to be out of rehab and this 20 minutes is going to be over. So I'm going to speed this up. It all worked out. The staff tortured me. I tortured them. I stayed in. They tacked a little extra time on my sentence. I stayed 35 days. And then I returned to work. My father lived 9 months. And when I was sober 9 months, the night before he died, my sister and my two brothers were in the waiting room of the intensive care unit, passed out, sound asleep, worn out from the days and days of agonizing waiting as my dad hovered between life and death. But because I was sober for only 9 months, I was still suffering greatly from insomnia, And I sat by my dad's side, reading a catalog, listening to the hums and the beeping. And all of a sudden, in 3 o'clock in the morning, he opened his eyes and he said, "Where am I?" And I said, "Dad, you're really sick. You're in the hospital. This is the intensive care unit. What are you reading?" "A catalog. Don't buy anything." So he said, "Did you have anything good to eat?" And, you know, he didn't, the last 5 days of his life, he didn't get anything to eat. So I didn't want to talk about food. And I said, "I'm going to tell you a little story." And I said, "Dad, do you remember when I was 10 years old? And on the Sunday morning, we woke up and there were 10 inches of snow on the ground. And I was so excited not to go to Sunday school. And you went to the garage and you got the little sled. And my little sister and I, my sister Lori, we jumped on the sled and you schlepped us for 10 blocks all the way to the Hebrew school on Sunday school." And he said, "Yeah, I've been meaning to tell you. I never expected you to get on the sled. You were too big." All right. You really are a fabulous audience. I'm going to move on now from this. And you know how this goes. A few hours later, the sun came up, and my father's time was over. But then when he died, we were all with him. That night, I made an AA meeting. And I raised my hand, and I said that my father had died. And during the break, a man came up to me, and he said, "My name's John, and I have 10 children. Where's the funeral?" That Sunday, that John, the man with 10 children, he came to my dad's funeral. He went on to become the delegate. He went on to become the head of AA, World Services, and, you know, performed the greatest function for our organization. But that back then, he was just a guy. And his name was John W. I bet a lot of you, John K. K. I'm sure a lot of you know him. I'm a little overwhelmed right now. Give me half a second, okay? I think for most part of my life, I've mistaken personality for character. And I think I worked really hard on my personality. Personal charisma was really important to me. And character was something only to be shown under extreme duress. After I was sober 3 years, I made that fatal mistake. I got married to somebody in the fellowship. And a bigger character never lived than my husband, Steve. And I have many, many opportunities in these last 25 years for each of us to work on our character, trying to, you know, make things work one day at a time. We got married. We started a business. Each of us worked. My husband got a master's degree. Life was good. We had our ups, we had our downs. We bought houses, we sold houses. And in the midst of all of this, one day we got a phone call that my husband's brother, in a moment of road rage, had gotten out of his car and stabbed another man to death. And my husband's reaction was very mixed. He felt terrible for his brother, but his brother had been really terrible to him, and there had been a long history of unhappiness and bitterness. And I told my husband that what we were going to do is we were going to pay for his niece and nephew's private schooling, We're going to pay the mortgage on his brother's house. We're going to keep food on that table. And we were going to do it for as long as his brother was incarcerated. And I can't tell you what it was like for us to undertake that burden. But we did it cheerfully, resolutely, sometimes angrily, sometimes with martyrdom, but we kept doing it. Even when we didn't know why we were doing it, we did it because it was the right thing to do and because we were sober. And the gift that was given to us, we felt we had to repay. When it comes to character, it is my expertise that when the chips are truly down, that's the absolute worst time to try to develop character. Because when things are really, really awful, you've got to lead with your A game. And if you don't have it, it's hard to fake. 3 years ago, my mother had a colossal stroke. It affected every part of her life. But most importantly, it affected her ability to continue to be independent. And as she hovered between life and death, I heard myself open my mouth and say, "Mom, you are coming home to live with me. I will care for you. I will never put you in a nursing home. And I will love and cherish you until the day you don't need my help anymore." Now, in the course of my being an alcoholic and in the course of my being in recovery, I've said a million sincere things that I didn't live to really do. But you know what? I did this. And it wasn't easy, and I had no idea what I was getting into. It's one thing to facilitate care for someone, but it's another thing to do all of it yourself. Talk about a difficult, isolating job. I can't even tell you what it was like. My mother and I, from that bitter moment when my father had that heart attack and then died, almost nine months later, my mother never really quite forgave me. I think she never really quite got the hang of this Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't have much patience for my husband and the life we lived and the kind of things we enjoyed doing and the fact that we were still going to meetings. It was all very strange, and the best way we could handle it all was to just the uneasy truce of unspoken action. You know, we just didn't talk about anything. So when my mother came to live with me, I guess I have to admit, there wasn't much love lost. And you know what happened? When my mother had the stroke, it changed her personality. And she didn't remember that she didn't love me. She thought I was the best daughter she ever had. And guess what? I wasn't going to tell her any different. And it was such a great, wonderful feeling to feel that unconditional love, not tempered at all with anger and regrets from the past, that I bent over backwards to do everything I could to be that daughter that she, now that she had the stroke, thought I always was. And so I would say that what I thought I was doing for her turned out to have been a great gift for me. How am I doing? Okay?
Great.
Okay. I feel like I'm getting a little moany and weepy here, but for some reason, this, you know how you practice in the car for this?
Yeah.
This wasn't exactly what I was practicing. I had a joke. My mom used to, after she had her stroke, she used to tell, like, this one dirty Jewish joke about blowing the chauffeur, which obviously I'm not going to. I can't believe I even said that. So, in conclusion, I wanted to say, if I were going to encapsulate the biggest thing I've learned in the last 29 years that would sum up my attitude about my character and trying to continually work and improve it, I'd say this. For many, many years, I lived my life as if it were, each day were my last. And somehow I thought I was doing the right thing. But more and more, I've come to realize that the best way to live each day as if it was your last day, not mine. So it's been a big change for me, and it's been a great honor. Happy 4th of July. Enjoy your freedom. Thank you so much.
And our next speaker is Gordy C. from Rhode Island.
My name is Gordy. Can you hear me? My name is Gordy C. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is Christmas Eve, 1974. I never thought I'd be here for almost 41 years. I didn't think I'd be here for 41 minutes. Believe me. I was the person that the family trying to figure out where the hell we get this kid from. I wasn't like anybody else in my family. It was a dysfunctional family, not because of alcoholism, but because my father was a lot older than my mother. He really didn't want any kids, and he was very physically and verbally abusive to my brother and I. So I chose to hang around with my friend the next corner, next street over. And he was very abusive, more to my brother than myself. And my mother and I would get in the middle of it and get hit. And so I hung out with this friend of mine. His mother was definitely an alcoholic, and we could always get booze off of her. So I came home around 11 or 12 years old, drunk out of my mind, first time in my life, and my father beat the living crap out of me. And he says, "You're never, ever going to do that again, right?" And I says, "Right." He turns around. I say, "Screw you." So he turns around and beats the living crap out of me again. He says, "You're never, ever going to say that again, right?" Right. He turns around. I called him another name. So you know what happened. I always had to have the last word, no matter how bad the consequences were. And the consequences were bad. I was very fortunate. I have a high IQ. I found out I could go to school or not go to school if I wished to. I'd stay out 2 weeks, go in and pass all the tests. That's not the way the system's supposed to work. You know, I would be getting grades like A5, A for the class and 5 for effort. And that's not the way it's supposed to match up. But I didn't care. So I started hanging out with friends who were losers just like me who didn't want to be bothered with school. And all of a sudden we started going to this place anyone from Rhode Island knows. It's called Sakanasit, which is a boys' training school for the bad boys. And I started going there on a regular basis, a very regular basis, 3 or 4 or 5 times. I lost track. Relatives would come down and say, "Where's Gordy?" "Well, you know, he's away again." They knew I wasn't on vacation. They knew where I was. I was back up there again. And the last time I had the bright idea of running away. So I ran away, got caught in New Bedford, brought back in handcuffs, I went before this same judgy wudgy who I'd went before many, many times before, who hated my guts. And he says, "I've got some choices for you. You're going to be 18 in 2 weeks, so you can go over the wall to the prison or you can go in the service." I'm waiting for number 3. No, number 3. I did not like either one of those choices, but I took the one to go in the service. So next thing I know, I'm on a plane going to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. to be in the service. The only thing is they failed to tell me a couple of things before I left. One of them, that you're supposed to take orders. Another one is you're supposed to salute people. And I don't know about you, but I don't do that. So that's what I told them when I got there. That didn't go over too well. Next thing I know, I'm in the stockade. I wonder why. And I'm sitting there brooding, what, how am I going to get out of this mess? And then I said, well, maybe I'll go underground with my drinking and I'll get to see the world. Well, I never got to see the world. I was stationed in Texas all the time I was there. And if you want some kind of idea where my mind was at, some buddies and I were standing in front of the Alamo taking pictures, and I collapsed on the ground. And I'm half conscious, half unconscious, and I go up like this and give the camera to one of my buddies, and I said, take a picture of me like this. And he did, and I sent it home to my mother. I thought it was hilarious. She failed to see the humor in it. She didn't think it was very funny. I still think it's funny, but anyways. So, and then after that, they made a really even bigger mistake. They gave me an honorable discharge. I still say it's a clerical error, but I'll take it. I'll take it. I'm not going to argue with them. And, of course, being the brainiac that I am, I'm not about to take a plane from Texas to Newport when I can take a bus and save all that money. That was about a three-month bus trip. I'm a blackout drinker. I never bothered to call my mother and let her know where I was. That's a dirty, rotten attitude. You know, it's none of her business. What a dirty, rotten attitude that I had. She loved the ground I walked on, and I couldn't even call her and let her know where I was and what I was doing. Well, I got home about 3 months later, and obviously I had no money. I had a sleeve ripped off my shirt, and I had a black eye. And that's and if you'd asked me where I was, I couldn't have told you anyways. So what I did was what I always did. My biggest cop-out's an alibi, so I can never be called an Elkie. I got an apartment, I got a car, and I got two or three jobs. I've always had two or three jobs. I just got rid of a couple of them a little over a year ago. You know, so that way there, I can't be one of these Elkies, see? Because when I was in the service, the medics told me if I continued to drink in the insane manner that I drink, and being half Native American, he said, you're going to have cirrhosis of the liver by the time you're 21. Try telling that to somebody 21. We don't listen very well. We're invincible. Tell it to somebody else. I don't want to hear it. Guess what? At 21, I got cirrhosis of the liver. Wonder how I got that. You know, and right there you can see where the character was. I didn't even have the common sense to call my family. All I cared about was me, and the hell with you. Next thing I know, I'm working in the restaurant field for years, and it was an Elkie's paradise for me. And the last place I worked was a place called the Viking Hotel in Newport. And it was on a Sunday afternoon, and they had a Sunday wedding brunch. And it was my turn to go up and serve the bride and the groom as they came down the through the table there. And just as they got to me, I went over in a grand mal Caesar on the floor. And the gravy and the roast and everything went all over the bride and groom. They'll never forget that wedding, I'm sure. I know I found out the hotel got sued. And they didn't take me back anymore for some reason. I didn't get it. Because for years I could always go back, but this time they weren't doing it. So next thing I know, I'm going to Newport Hospital for the first time in my life. Intensive care unit. Last rites. You don't get much worse than that when you get the last rites. And as you can see, I survived. So what did that tell me? Those quacks don't know what the hell they're talking about. I can drink. Tell it to somebody else. And I started drinking in a more insane manner than I ever did. I can remember days I couldn't get a haircut without a drink. I couldn't mow the lawn without a drink. And eventually, I couldn't even go get a drink without a drink. That's pretty bad. That's alcoholism. Full steam ahead, alcoholism, you know, and I'm walking around, yellow jaundice all the time. I'm in my 20s, yellow jaundice, yellow eyes, hair all the way down my back, and I'm just drinking myself to death. Putting my poor mother through a hell on earth. You know, I don't know how many times the wagon came to get me because I'm laying on the bedroom floor with my head hitting up against the bedboard, and she wondered what that noise was. It was me and another grandma's seizure, And she's riding her emergency wagons all the time. And I'm saying I'm not hurting anyone but myself. You know, unbelievable egotism of the alcoholic. Well, I was in and out of Newport Hospital without any word of exaggeration. There are people here that know that 60 times in 8 years. I've been in that hospital so many times, I knew just about every doctor and nurse on a first-name basis. And after a while, I became like part of the hospital property. This is a bedpan, this is a thermos, this is a Gordy. I was like part of the place. I was always there. You know, some people thought I worked there. I was always there. In and out and in and out and in and out, and I could not stop drinking. But, you know, there was a group called the Just for Today group. They met at that hospital for years. And these nosy AA people were coming up bothering me, talking about this AA stuff. That's for Elkies, not for me. Talk about denial. I'm there dying, and they're talking. And I always promised them I would go to AA, but, of course, I never did. Because you're not going to brainwash me. So what I hope and pray was my last drink was Christmas Eve, 1974. And I know my higher power picked that time. I certainly didn't. I went to this place called Battery Park in Newport with lots and lots and lots of booze. And I don't know if I was trying to kill myself or not, but I almost made it. Well, after that, all I know is what people told me. There was a nunnery across the street, and the nuns found me in the snow with blood running out of every part of my body. And again, I'm going back to Newport Hospital intensive care unit. I woke up attached to 8 machines, and every single one of them, and one in particular, made this horrible, horrible noise, which I had nightmares about for years. And the doctors were very upfront. They said that I had less than 2% chance to live, and if I did, I'd be a vegetable for the rest of my life. It was all over. I'm 28. It's all over. I had my chances. That was it. Here come those nosy AAs again. They're coming to my room again. Can't I even die in peace? Here they come again. I'm saying that very affectionately because they saved my life, believe me, among other people. And these so-called nosy AA people even donated blood for me, and I have a rare blood type. And they were praying for me at all the meetings on the island that I would live. And that was almost 41 years ago. So as you can see, all those prayers were answered. Little by little, they took the bits and pieces of machinery away. I think the doctors are still shaking their head. There's no way I was supposed to survive. I've had the last race 4 times. There's no way I'm supposed to survive, but here I am. Little by little, they took the bits and pieces of machinery away. And the doctor says, I don't care what he says. You throw his big fat butt in that wheelchair, and you bring him down to the AA meeting. Now, picture this. Here I am at my first AA meeting. I'll never forget it. I weighed about 370 pounds. It wasn't from eating too much. I don't know if you've ever seen severe chronic cirrhosis of the liver. It's not a pretty picture. I literally had a stomach out here. I had legs the size of tree trunks. My head was like this. Yeah, here we go. And I always make a dramatic opening. And they wheeled me into that meeting. And I had on my blue sunglasses so you couldn't see my yellow eyes. I had on my native headband, so you know my heritage, and they wheeled me into that meeting. And you can imagine what people were thinking and saying. And all of a sudden, I heard about fellowship and camaraderie and spirituality. And part of me said, wow, at last I'm home. And the Elkie side says, what are you, you don't need this crap, you got it together. Can you imagine it? I had it together. People later on told me they thought that someone brought a dead body in the wrong room looking for the morgue. I was like a yellowish-purple color. And on top of that, I had a very filthy, nasty mouth because I was angry because all of this is your fault. How come all this is happening to me so young? So people would come over, how you doing? I'd say, fine, screw you. I was a bundle of joy. They just really loved to see me there. And I made one big error. I said it to this woman named Marie Yu, who has since passed on, who was really, really essential in my first days. I made the mistake of saying that to Marie, and nobody says that to Marie, but I didn't know that. She says, you big fat so-and-so, I'll kick you in that so-and-so wheelchair down the stairs. Uh-oh. All of a sudden, I learned etiquette very quick. Very quickly, I learned etiquette. She says, you know what? I'm going to hang on to you right now till you get a male sponsor. And I'm going to come over to your house every single day, and if you're not on that street corner, on that sidewalk, on the time that you're supposed to be there, and if I see you walking down the street, I will run you over. And I think she would have. There was none of this, do you please want to go to AA crap way back then. You better get moving. You was insulted every single minute. I can remember being told, sit up front and make believe you're a human. Nice little things like that, you know. Or, some are sicker than others. You just won first prize. You know, nice little things like that is what they told you back then. And I was putting up with it. I couldn't believe it. So one day I'm at this meeting, and she says, you see that guy in the corner over there? He's going to be your sponsor. I said, but I don't know him. She says, well, a-hole, go over there and talk to him. What are you talking to me for? So I go over there, and he's talking to other people. And here's a king waiting. What's the matter with him? Hurry up. And finally he talks to me, and he says, you know what? I'll think about it. The king just humbled himself, and he's going to think about it? I'm going to drink. I'll show him. But I didn't. 2 weeks later, he comes up to me and says, you know what? I thought about it. I think I'll give you a chance. I thought I was giving him a chance. What's this all about? But anyways, I kept going to the meetings because honestly, deep down inside, I loved the meetings from day one, but I'm not going to tell you that. Anyways, he was my sponsor for 15 and a half years, and thank God for him and Marie. And Reggie, who's my sponsor now, who's in the audience, thank God for those people because they really, really saved my life. So after a while, one day my sponsor comes up to me, you know, and he says, I'm sicker than others. That was got to be a habit. And he says, and I really believe that you need a halfway house. And as a matter of fact, you're going this afternoon. It's all set up. I wanted to kill him. But no, next thing you know, I'm the youngest one in the house. I still had a lot of physical problems. I'm surprised they took me. A good thing about it is I was in Fall River, Mass. I didn't know a soul in Fall River, Mass, because I knew people just about everywhere else. So everybody I met was sober. So that was great because I learned how to live and socialize the way you're supposed to, you know. And so I finished the program there, came back to Newport, and I joined the Just for Today group at the Newport Hospital. And Reggie, my sponsor now, and Robbie and some other people way back then, we started the original Newport Young People's Group, and after that we started the Newport Young People's Conference, which is now called the Ocean State Conference, which has been going on for almost 40 years, and I'm proud to be a part of that. But, you know, all of a sudden I'm going to these meetings, and here's a person that never, ever cared about anybody. Now, all of a sudden, I started to care about people, whether they drank or not. That's kind of strange. That was new to me. I cared about somebody I didn't even like if they drank again. This is really, really new to me. What's this all about? Even to the extent that at 11 months sober, I wasn't even sober a year, I rented this apartment on Broadway in Newport. It was a 3-room apartment on the third floor, and it had a deck out on the back. And I said to myself, I'm going to take in any guy that has no place to stay and is serious about recovery. And I went to a commitment that night in Fall River, and that's the first time I made that statement. And this guy, Alan, came up to me afterwards and talked to me. The next day, he was on my front steps, and Alan was the first one in Gordy's. They used to call it Gordy's Little Halfway House, which really wasn't a halfway house. But, you know, see, what had happened with Alan was he was on hitchhiking to a meeting. He was hitchhiking around on the highway. And he told me later on that he was depressed and he was going to keep hitchhiking, go in the woods and kill himself. Well, this driver picked him up who happened to be an AA and brought him to an AA meeting instead, and I happened to be speaking there. Coincidence? I don't think so. Alan came to come and live with me for a year and a half, and I haven't seen Alan in like 30-something years. And about 3 months ago, I was asked to be an anniversary speaker at the Providence Young People's Group. And when I got through speaking, this man stands up and says, my name is Alan. Thank you for saving my life 39 years ago. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I have another gentleman here that I just ran into tonight. I haven't seen in a few years. Keith, with 37 years, who was another one of my guys in the house. I had another guy, Gary, who at the time needed medications really bad. Because he would go to meetings and actually get down on four legs and bark like a dog. He really did. And people say, you're taking that so-and-so into your house. I said, yeah, mind your own business. And Gary's got 18 or 19 years sobriety today. I don't give up on anybody. If anyone's got a breath of life in them, you know, you don't give up on them. So I think maybe my character might have changed a little bit through the years. I cared about these people. You know, well, in any job, you never get the satisfaction that I get out of seeing a newcomer change before your very eyes. They come in, you know, looking like hell, feeling hopeless and helpless like I did. And then 3 months later, they're starting to look better physically. And next thing you know, they're up at the podium chairing meetings. And, boy, I never got a high like that out of booze. Never. Believe me, I never got a high like that out of booze. My sponsor, you know, he said to me, you know, why don't you go back to school? You're very smart. Go back and do it. So I went back and I got my GED. And because of this program, I've been able to go from a GED to a PhD. And that's a lots and lots of hard work, lots and lots of commuting. At one time, I lived in Providence. I commuted to Newport, where I worked. I worked at Edge Hill Newport. And from Newport, I commuted to Boston to school all in the same day. It was like a 19-hour day, and I did that for years. And people would say, I saw you in Connecticut. I saw you in Massachusetts. Where do you live? I said, I don't know. Who cares? I'm sober. Who the hell cares where I live? I don't know. I don't know. So, and eventually in 1995, I got my doctorate. So now I'm, you know, Dr. C, whoopee-doo. And the reason I say that is, see, because I got to be careful about this doctor stuff, see, because when I was drinking, I was a doctor too. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I got to be careful I don't get too big for my britches, you know. I got to be careful because I know those pieces of paper on my wall will make good toilet paper if I think I can drink again, because that's all they'd be good for. You know? I've been in the mental health and substance abuse field for almost 39 years. And everyone that comes into any facility I work with, just me all over again with a different story and a different name. You know, in 1980, I met my partner. And he was a former, very popular entertainer. He was the opening act for Diana Ross. He was the opening act for Engelbert Humperdinck, the Shirelles, the Chantels, and he was, you know, well-known all over the country. He just got off the road. And while being on the road, you know, they would perform all night, sleep half the day. So he took, years ago, they used to have this thing on the matchbox where they could sign up for different courses. He signed up for a drapery course. And so when I met him, he had opened up a drapery shop, and he was making these beautiful custom-made drapes and gowns. And that's when I met him. And this is the first time in my life I left a job without having a job. I left Boston and I moved to Providence, and we moved into Silver Lake in Providence. We lived in Providence for 12 years. He never knew what an elkie was. The only thing is he never allowed anyone drinking in his band. And he even had to fire his own cousin 3 or 4 times. As much as he loved it and what a good drummer he was. And eventually Jimmy ended up killing himself by crashing a car into a pole. And so eventually I got Dick involved and interested in the substance abuse field. So for the last 15 years, he was the office manager for AdCare in Warwick. First of all in North Dartmouth and then in Warwick. And sometimes he was more capable than some of the therapists. A lot of them told me that they were ready to leave, and they came and talked to Richard, and he convinced them to stay, you know, and we had a wonderful, beautiful relationship together for 32 years. 32 years. And a little over 3.5 years ago, about 3.5 years ago, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. And lung cancer runs in his family. His father died from it. 4 uncles died from it. 4 cousins died from it. But he had not drank he had not smoked a cigarette in 26 years. So he said to me one day about 3 or 4 years ago, you know, I'm going to die from cancer someday. I said, cut the crap. You don't even smoke. He says, I know, but I just feel that's going to happen. And I said, no, you're not. He was involved. Thank God he was involved in Al-Anon for 25 years. You know, and he was part of starting some of the first Al-Anon groups in Providence. You know, and he just loved. In the beginning, he was very, very jealous of me going to all these meetings. And I said, you can, there's some place you can go too. And it wasn't to hell, believe me. And he got involved in Al-Anon and sponsoring people. And, you know, he was doing the same thing I was doing, only, you know, for the sister program. So anyways, when he was diagnosed with cancer, he got chemotherapy, radiation, and he wanted acupuncture. And for 8 months, everything worked. He never lost any weight. He never lost any hair. He worked right up to 5 weeks before he passed away. And eventually, the last 2 months, nothing worked. Nothing worked. And much as he wanted to get up and go to work, he couldn't. And eventually, 8 days in Miriam Hospital, and they asked him, when's the last time you've been hospitalized? He said, 67 years ago when I was born. He had never been in a hospital in his life. That's how well he kept himself. And 8 days later, he went to hospice, and 8 days in hospice. He had 210 visitors in 8 days. That's because they were former fans, former people that worked with them, clients and everything else. And to go back a little bit, we talked to him doing an oldie show in 1988, and he was unbelievable. He performed with Tavares. And anyway, so now here I am, and on October the 20th of 2012, the worst tragedy that's ever happened to me in my life, drunk, sober, otherwise, is his passing. I've been devastated for years. I go to grief groups, and they help me tremendously. Whenever I run into anybody that has any issues with grief, whether they be in the program or not, I try to help them. Because even though I didn't want to be, I could become quite the expert on it. So I think maybe my character has changed a little bit through in the last 40-something years. I care about other people sometimes more than I care about myself. So we had a big house in Johnson. I had to sell it and move back to Newport. I had not been in Newport in 34 years, so after 34 years of being away, I moved back. Luckily, we had a little rental house down there we never sold, so I moved into the little rental. I went from an 11-room house in Johnston to a 3-room house in Newport. Well, that doesn't matter because after he died, it wasn't a house. I wasn't a home anymore. It was just a house, and I didn't need it. And I failed to tell you, we got two beautiful Cavalier King Charles Spaniels that Dick decided we needed, and because I've had 6 deaths in 6 years. My mother, my brother, my second sponsor, my favorite aunt, my partner, then my partner's mother 1 month later. I've had 6 in a row. So luckily, these beautiful, wonderful dogs, Adam and Eve, he named them, by the way. Those are my babies. And thank God that they're with me. And you know, once in a while, it's been 2.5 years, once in a while I might make a mistake and say a term that he used to say. And his dog, Evie, would run around the house looking for him, even now. You know, they really, really know. And some nights when I have a really, really bad time and I'm crying my eyes out, Adam will knock on every door in the house to get to me. And he jumps up and puts his paws around me and hugs me. Unconditional love. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it. You know, AA has been a wonderful program for me. All of the promises have been given to me time and time over again. Today, I'm a man of integrity, faith, and character, and that's all because of you people. It just so happened also tonight, you're not supposed to have favorite sponsees, but I happen to have two, and they both have the same name, one from 37 years ago and one from 10 months ago, and both their names are Keith, and they're both sitting over there together. This beautiful, wonderful, God-given program works. So don't give up before the battle. You know, give up before you get crossing over into the line, the winning line. I don't know about you, but for me, it's AA or amen. Thank you.
great job by all our speakers. And when I came in the program, I didn't think I had any character defects, but I soon learned after that I do. And it seems like at this convention, one just keeps popping up, and it's called impatience. Like, why are people saving two rows of seats? Can't people move faster so I can get out of this building? Why is everybody lined up in the at the restaurants and the food court? And then I had to say to myself, well, there's 60,000 people here together. What do you expect? So at least I don't think I act out the way I used to, because I, like someone mentioned, I always like to get the last word. If you're arguing with someone and they want the last word, things are going to go on and on and on, you know. So anyway, it's been a great panel, and I'd like to thank our three participants. They did a great job.